Okay, we are in Ezra Perek Daled, chapter 4. As I said in the weekly email about this, that we're actually going to start moving faster now, not in the sense of making things more confusing, but in the sense that we've introduced enough elements that now the story is going to make sense, and we'll be able to go through the story at a much quicker pace. But before we do that, I wanted to summarize where we've been, in order to sort of bring us all up to speed. People have been away, or people have been here, but you know, we've gone into some detours. So, chapter one of the book is the reign of King Cyrus. Cyrus is the Persian king who conquers Babylon, and in the beginning of his reign, he allows the Jews to return and to build the Beis HaMikdash, to build the temple. That is the license that he presents to them, not to build up the walls of Jerusalem, not to have an autonomous country. You're still going to be living under the Persians, but go home and build a temple, much as we saw, he permitted the Babylonians to do similar things. It wasn't just about us. And that was chapter one. Chapter two, we saw who returned. And we had 42,000 and change Jews come back to the land, led by Sheshbazzar, led by Zerubbabel. They may be the same person, they may not be. Also led by Yehoshua, who would become Kohen Gadol, although he's not as visible in the beginning of the story. We saw the breakdown by lineage. We have all sorts of reasons for why the book includes the list. I'm not going to go over that now. But the point is, that's what was in the second chapter. The Jews are on their way back into their land. Then, in chapter 3, we found that the returnees scattered to their cities, most likely simply for practical reasons. They needed to plant crops, they needed to develop a society. But then, in the month of Tishrei, they banded together, they came to Jerusalem to build an altar. Whether that's they waited to band together because they were afraid of their enemies, or now they built the altar because they were afraid of their enemies, we discussed that at the time, but they build an altar, they start bringing karbanot, they start bringing offerings, they celebrate the holiday of Sukkot, and they get to work building a Beit HaMikdash. And there we had a little bit of a detour to note that those elements seem to be mirrored in Nehemiah chapter 7, and we said that may be the same story, it may not be the same story. If it is the same story, then that means that as and Nehemiah are actually already here at this stage, although they may be listed under different names. Okay? But again, what I want to do with this summary is just establish our storyline. I don't want to get distracted by all the things that we've spent hours and hours on. For that, you can go back to the recordings. But the point is, they're now in their land, they've celebrated Sukkot, they have an altar, they don't have a temple. And so they start to actually construct the building. Then in the beginning of chapter 4, the Samaritans offer to build with us, and either we feel that they are insincere and they're trying to bog things down, Rashi's approach, or alternatively, they wanted to be built, but they intended to be multi-purpose. It's going to be the Jews' temple, and it's also going to be their temple for their gods. Remember, the Samaritans were non-Jews who were moved into the Shomron by Assyrians over a period of time, and they had their own gods who they worshipped. Out of fear, they also accepted our God, but apparently they don't reject their original gods. We refuse. And so they said, well, we are going to show you, we're going to stop you from building it. And then the text said, we refused their help. We said, thanks, but no thanks, Cyrus permitted us to build it. And so they start obstructing, and that obstruction continues both by direct intimidation of the builders and by lobbying the Persians, continues all the way into the time of Darius. And that was where we then saw a story begin of such an obstruction. Either that story of obstruction, which is in the middle of chapter 4, is from this moment in time, and it's about obstruction of the construction of the temple. Obstruction, construction, two different words. Either it's obstruction of the construction of the temple, or this story is borrowed from later in our history when we're trying to build the walls of Jerusalem. And it's a story about that obstruction, and it's only brought here because we said, yeah, this obstruction is going to go on for a very long time in the future. You follow? That's all we've done. We haven't done a whole lot. You can sum up in 4 minutes and 57 seconds everything that we spent the last 12 weeks on. So that's where we are. We are in a story which is either taking place in the time when we're building the walls of Jerusalem, or taking place during the time when we are building the temple itself. Good.
Yes. It's an earlier stage in which just the Mizbeach is built.
The first stage in general, this is something to keep in mind in terms of overall structure. The first stage, what Cyrus permits, is just construction of the temple. The Mizbeach, the altar, is built already. We build the altar in the seventh month in Tishrei.
Then the building around it.
Correct. First altar, then temple. But that's all the first stage. It's only when we get to Ezra and then Nehemiah, that we see construction of the walls of the city. Clear? We're going to talk about, as we go through this story, reasons to view this as being about the walls versus reasons to view this as being about the temple beyond what we said last week. But let's not confuse things more than we need to. So chapter 4, sentence 7 is the beginning of this story. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want page 1821. And it begins, we saw it last week, with a letter to Artaxasta. Artaxasta is either the title given to Persian kings, and it could refer to Cyrus, Darius, whoever. And that's the view you'll take if you believe that this story is happening during the reign of King Cyrus, that Artaxasta is just a title. Or this is a king named Artaxasta, potentially Artaxerxes, perhaps. And in that case, this story is taking place later in the construction of the city. Either way, they send the letter to Artaxasta, and all we saw were a bunch of names. In sentence 7, we said Mithridates, Tavel, possibly Bishlam, depending on how I understood the word Bishlam, write this letter. The letter is written in Aramaic, meaning Aramaic text, as well as the Aramaic language. And then we saw the names Rechum and Shimshai as writers of the letter. And we explained that either Rechum and Shimshai are simply the actual physical writers, whereas you had, you have your committee that sits down to draft the letter, and then you have the ones who are actually going to do the job. And so you have a scribe, his name is Shimshai, and you have Rechum, who takes what the committee did and says, you know what, I know how these letters are supposed to be written, and it's not quite in the right format to be accepted, so I'm going to reformat the letter in order to fit. Rechum Baal Ta'im. That's one way to look at it. And then we had Malbim's radical suggestion, which is going to matter a great deal, which is, that's not why you have Rechum and Shimshai. Rechum and Shimshai are actually the key to the entire story. And he's going to use this to explain a whole bunch of things. So it's very important to catch this. He says, when you have a big empire, as the Persians do, then you can't demand of every land that they learn Persian and write their letters to the empire in Persian and deal with the fact that that's not their tongue. Rather, in every land you have staff people who are responsible to do translation. They're in the employ of the king. They work for the Persian Empire. And Rechum and Shimshai are the local ones here. If the community wants to send a letter to the throne, they write the letter in their own tongue. Rechum and Shimshai are responsible to translate it into Persian and send it along. Then the king sends his response back in Persian. It gets to Rechum and Shimshai, and they translate it back for the community. That's where the letters work. That's a key point which you have to keep in mind in order to understand how Malbim is going to take this story altogether, because it's going to solve a lot of problems if you adopt his way of doing things. Correct.
When they sent the letters up to.
Well, with good reason. Where are they? Rechum and Shimshai are in Judea. Right? Judy doesn't figure at all in Megillat Esther. Yeah. Why it doesn't is a good question. But it doesn't, yes.
But also in Megillat Esther, they say, Kilshanah, right? That they actually did the translations centrally, I think, at the palace, and then dispatched them. Each land had its own language.
Right, so the question is, where are people like Rehum and Shimshai located? Are they at headquarters, or are they in the actual land? But yes, there has to be... I mean, it's just a logistical thing. You have to do translation, otherwise what are you going to do?
But in the provinces, you only need somebody who knows two languages, Persian and the local language.
You mean in the...
In the capital, you need translators for the whole...
It doesn't have to be one person. Each unit is going to have its own, you know, each satrapy or whatever you want to call it is going to have its own team of translators. That would be the way it would work. So the letter is being written, drafted, and then written. But what does it actually say? So now we finally get to the letter itself. Chapter 4, sentence 12. Again, it's page 1821 if you're using the stone Tanakh. We now know who wrote it. We know the committee. We know the writers. What did they actually say? Yedia lahave lamalcha. Right, Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12. We are in Aramaic. We're going to remain in Aramaic for a while, just to let you know. So, Yedia lahave lamalcha. Be it known to the king. Di Yehudaye di Saliku min levasach. The Jews who left you, Alena Asol Yerushalayim, they have come to us in Jerusalem. Kiryasa Maradata Uvishta Bonayin. Now, I'm translating this sentence one way. There are multiple ways to translate it, as we'll see. But they are building the city which is rebellious and wicked. Vishuraya ishach Vishuraya shachlilu, and they have strengthened the walls. Ve'ushaya yachitu. Ushaya are either walls or foundations. There are two different ways to render the word, as brought in the commentators. Rashi says ushaya are walls. Ibn Ezra Mitzudat David and others say it's foundations, which probably makes sense in the sense that shuraya were already the walls. So why would I need two different words for walls in this? So the walls or the foundations, yachitu. Yachitu is from the word chut. So it usually is rendered as to tie things together. Although there's a creative read by Ibn Ezra who says a chut is a plumb line. Huh. Yeah, when you want to build, you need a plumb line to make sure everything is straight. So they've extended the plumb line across the foundations. It's Aramaic. Aramaic is a sister language of Hebrew.
So you're
sister language or nephew language, if you like. Niece language. There's a lot of overlap. There is a lot of overlap in between the two. They happen to have, in the Dan Mikra edition, below the text, they have a Hebrew translation. So if I get stuck, I can always, you know, turn to that. But the words are so similar that, yeah, I mean, you can hear it. Bonayin, they're building. Bonim in Hebrew. You know, much of it is in fact the same, and yeah. So these Jews who have left you have showed up here, and they're building up this horrible city of Jerusalem, this rebellious city of Jerusalem. Ka'an, he says now, Yedia lahave lamalka, be it known to the king. He says, when they build this city is built up. If these walls are going to be strengthened, you know what's going to happen? Minda below vahalach la yintinun. Minda below vahalach. These are three taxes that are levied on not just the Jews, but on every community. The Medrash takes the word minda. It's a Gemara in Nedarim. Minda is a land tax, below is a head tax, and halach is arnona. Arnona, of course, in modern Hebrew, is still a tax. The Rush, commenting on the Gemara Nedarim, says it's a tax on animals. Ibn Ezra, just because he's Ibn Ezra, says Minda is a tax on property, like the land tax of the Gemara. Below is a head tax, just like the Gemara says, but halach, he says, is like the word, halach, which means... It's a toll, exactly. It's a toll for travel. Lalechet, to go. So, because Ibn Ezra, he'll quote you two-thirds of the Gemara, and then the last third he'll just give you his own rendition. The point that the Persians are making is not about the Gemara. The point the Persians are making is, the minute you let these Jews build up this city, and they feel safe within their city, you know what's going to happen? Layintanun. They're not going to give the taxes. They're going to stop paying taxes because now they have their defenses. They're going to declare freedom. V'apsom malchim tahanzik. Apsom is one of those words that's very hard to render. Rashi says it's the tax. Similarly, Ben Ezra says it's income. Dan Mikra says it's the throne. What they're trying to say is the king is going to be harmed by this. If you're really going to let them build up the walls of the city, then they're going to declare independence. And for us, you know, if you want to know why do we care, why are we getting involved, we're good citizens. Ka'an, now, we're in Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14, Kol kavel dimalach hechla malachna. We literally eat the salt of the empire, or of the palace. I'm going to explain that phrase later, so hang on to that phrase. But we use the salt of the palace. V'arvas malkala arich lana lemechazeh. And we wouldn't want to see the erva of the king. Erva means something which is usually covered, in its literal sense, but it comes to mean more than a part of the body. It means that which a person would be embarrassed to have exposed, a source of shame. And so what they're saying is it would be a humiliation of the king. If you were to allow this to happen, the Jews would no longer observe your laws, they would no longer pay your taxes. Think Ahasuerus and Purim, and they don't, you know, Haman's claim, right? They're not going to listen to the government. So, therefore, we have decided that we're going to take action. Al dina, because of this, shalachna behodana lamalka, we have sent this information to the king, and they say, don't trust us. This is in your records. Have it investigated. Look in the records, the chronicles of your ancestors. Uzahashkach, and you will find Bispar Dochranaya in the book of records, right? Dochranaya, Sefer Zikaron. Look in your records and you'll find Visinda, then you will know. The Kiryasadach, Kiryamarata, that this is a rebellious city. Umahanzikis Malchin Umedinan. They harm kings and empires. The Eshtador Abdin Begava Minyamos. Minyomas Alma, they've always been this way. Eshtador is either rebellion, or according to Ibn Ezra, they send messengers to make alliances with others. Lishader is to send. How do you say in Hebrew today when you talk about something being televised or broadcast?
Tashdir
or Shidur, right? Shidur Chai is live broadcast. It's to send. So they send messages everywhere, they make alliances everywhere in order to cause trouble, these Jews. Al-Dana Kiryasada Hachravas. He says, that's why it was destroyed in the first place. You want to know what happened to them? Why Nebuchadnezzar did this to them? Look in your record books, which is true. Meaning, if you open the Tanakh, you don't need to know the Persian records. You know, we rebelled twice against Nebuchadnezzar before the temple was destroyed. He didn't come in looking to do it. He came in looking to subjugate us and have us pay him. Right? That was the initial assault. And it was when we said, we're not having this, and rebelled, that he came back. And then he came back again. That's our history. So therefore, they conclude their record, their letter in sentence 16. Mahod in anachna lamalka, we inform the king. Dihein kiryas adach tisbenei v'shuraya yishtach lalun. If this city is built up, if its walls are going to be strengthened, l'kavel denach halak ba'avar nara la'isai loch. When that happens, you will no longer have a portion on the other side of the Jordan. Meaning our side of the Jordan. The western side of the Jordan. You're going to lose your empire here. Because these Jews are going to rebel against you. That's the Samaritan letter. They didn't like us. Here's an interesting note. Take a look at source number 1 on the sheet. After I gave you that summary of where we've been, that we spent our first few minutes on today. This is from the Encyclopedia Mikra'it. I find the Encyclopedia Mikra'it very interesting. I have by way of background, I've mentioned, I think, in past years, my great uncle, my grandfather's half brother, was Naftali Hertz Tur Sinai, the professor of Bible at Hebrew U. Did a lot of work in Semitic languages, did a lot of work in Eov in particular. So his son-in-law, Emmanuel Shiloh, told me, you have to, if you're going to teach Ezra, you have to read Encyclopedia Mikrait. And so I got a hold of a set, and he was right. He unfortunately passed away a couple of months ago. But he was 100% right. There's so much there, but you have to be very careful when you read it, meaning that you have to know where this is coming from. This is not meant to be a religious book by any stretch of the imagination. It is meant to present to you current contemporary biblical scholarship, which sometimes you may like, and sometimes you may have an issue with. You have to know what it is that you're reading. But if you want to know what the world is saying, it's presented in a very clear and concise form with references you can then look up. It's in Hebrew. And I have certainly found it to be quite useful. It is not available online, regrettably. So, in this Encyclopedia Mikrait, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tzvi Siegel wrote the entry that I'm showing you here. He says about these letters that are going to go back and forth between Judea and the Samaritans and the throne. He says, scholars from the previous generation have cast doubt upon the authenticity of the original Aramaic text that you're seeing here. And especially they denied the truth of the official documents that are recorded. But he says Edward Meyer, who was a scholar in his own right, has demonstrated their credibility. The Kitvei Yov should galu acharkach, as well as Kitvei Yov. Kitvei Yov are papyri from Elephantine, in which there's, you know, Elephantine in Egypt. There was a thriving Jewish community for a very long time. So the papyri that have been found there have actually matched this. Vadomim lemakor ha'arami b'lashonam b'signonam, testifying to the authenticity of the language and the style, showing that, yeah, these look like what real letters would have looked like. And that supported their authenticity. So, you know, when you read something like this here, and then you find that there's actually contemporary evidence to support this, I think it's important to note that. Okay. So the letter says, don't let the Jews rebuild. Catch something very interesting in Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12. Going back to the beginning of the letter. Did you notice the way the Jews are described?
The Jews who were kicked out.
That's not what it says. The Jews who left. Did we leave them? I mean, we did. We were sent. That's not what he says. The Jews who left you, as opposed to the Jews you sent. Now, there are a couple of different explanations for why the Samaritans would have written this, right? Why would they write the Jews who left you, as opposed to the Jews you sent?
It's more derogatory to Jews.
Could be. Could be it's more derogatory. What else?
Their independence.
Their independence? Could be.
They gave it up. Why did you give it back to them?
Well, no, they left you in Persia.
Oh,
they didn't leave.
Left
yeah,
you.
Shana.
It provides an excuse for intervention.
Yeah, meaning?
Meaning, if you never gave them one, okay, why are they leaving you? You're entitled to go back and take them back.
Right. It affords Cyrus plausible deniability.
The Karma doesn't translate that.
How do they translate it?
Be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from thee to us.
Right. Right, I mean, that's the same thing. But saliku, lesalek, is to leave. You could say it means to go up, but I don't feel beholden to go up.
Separate with
yeah. Right, I mean, lesalek in general is to remove something. If you were, you know, doing that to something else, I think on one level it's plausible deniability to say to him, you know, we don't want to say to him, you let them come here and you made a big mistake. But, you know, they left your land, and now they're going to do a terrible thing. It isn't an accusation of Cyrus. That's one possible point. However, it's also possible that they actually are sincere. Maybe the Samaritans believe this. In other words, the Jews came to the land saying, Cyrus sent us here to build a temple, and made a big point, so that when the Samaritans said, we want to build with you, they said, no, Cyrus told us, it's supposed to be us. It may be they don't believe us. You know?
It has a very contemporary sound to it. This whole sound bite thing, it's sort of like the way everybody writes the news.
Yeah.
You know, it puts their own spin on it. This
right.
is their spin.
Right.
And, you know, it just shows you how this was going on thousands of years.
Oh, it's going to get even better when we get to Malvern. But yes, absolutely.
The Palestinians will tell one story. The Jews will tell another story.
You got it. You got it. Don't start. Don't start. I don't need that. The so again, the Jews who left are building up this city. Now here, I played a trick in translating sentence 12, the latter half of sentence 12. So I want to know how your Tanakh will translate this. After it says they've arrived in Jerusalem. Right, the art scroll says they have arrived. Right, have arrived in Jerusalem. They are constructing a rebellious and villainous city. Is that the way the other translations read? I'm not keying on the words rebellious and villainous. The breakup of the sentence.
Well, isn't there an etnafta under Zushalayim? Wouldn't that be how it's broken up?
That's absolutely one way to read it. How else could you read it?
Why would there be a stop sign there?
Sorry?
Why would there be a stop sign?
Right, no, and that fits one way to read it. But the trap, even in Achta, is not dispositive. It's possible for there to be a read that goes against it. There are other cases like that. How else could you read this sentence? I mean, the establishers of the trap want us to read it this way. But there is another way you could read it. How else could you read it if you ignore the trap? Sorry?
The Jerusalem is the rebellion.
The Jews who left you have come to Jerusalem, the city that is rebellious and wicked. They are building and strengthening walls and doing foundations and so on. The question is, which way do you read the word they are building? Is it that they are building the city that is wicked and villainous, or they've come to a city that is wicked and villainous and they are building? Mm-hmm. Now, why does that matter? Because that's the whole dating of this story. If I read it the way that the Trump wants me to read it and the way that the art scroll translates it, then the allegation is they have come to Jerusalem and they are building a city. In that case, the story has to be later. Because in the early part of the story, they're not building a city. They're building a temple. They're building a Beis HaMikdash. How in the world can you make an allegation to the Persians that we're building a city when there is no city? You follow? You know you're going to get caught. How can you make that charge? So if you read it this way, the way the Trump fits it, the way the art scroll translates it, this story has to be a later story. If, however, you read it as they've come to Jerusalem, the villainous and terrible city, they are building walls and foundations, is talking about the temple. And it's an earlier story. You see? It's all where you put the comma. That's what's going to change this story. But now here's the problem. All of our traditional commentaries, as we saw at length last week, thought that this is an early story. Right? They thought that this fit in earlier. Whatever I have to do to King Artaxasta and King Darius to make them fit, whether it's all in sequence of kings, whether they're all one king, however I'm going to do it, the traditional read has this as an early story. They're not building a city. If so, how do they deal with this sentence? Do they really say to reread the sentence against the trap? So here is where Malvim's genius comes into play. This is fantastic. Take a look at source number 2. I brought this for you and translated it at length because I felt like you had to see it in the way that he did it. Remember Malbim's allegation. He says that Shimshai and Rechum are employees of the Persian Empire. They're supposed to translate the letter into Persian, and they're on the take. They're being paid off by the Samaritans. When we said the Samaritans hired people, this is where their money went. So watch what they did. Because Malvim believes that this story is going on in the beginning, when they're building a temple, not building a city. So he says, he says, yeah, that's where the trick and the forgery, not literally, but the lie, of the copyists, that's where the trick went in. Because you have two ways to read it. You could say that the rebellious city is going back with the earlier part of the sentence. They've come to Jerusalem, which is a rebellious, wicked city. Umilas banayin, and the word they are building, that's its own word, going with the next part. Rotzalomar, meaning Shabonim Sham Binyan, they're building a building there. Dainu Shabonim Sham is Beis HaMikdash, V'yistu Chomos HaBayis, they're building the temple, they establish the walls of the temple, and so on. V'yesh Lefarish, but you could also explain, Shemilas Banayin Mechuberim Kiryasam Aradata Uvishta, that the word building goes back with the wicked and rebellious city. Rotzalomar, Shabol Yerushalayim, Vein Bonim Esayir, Hamaredes Vahara'ah. They've come to Jerusalem and they're building this rebellious and wicked city. You can read it either way. And he says, that's the point. Vehem Ha'etiku Kain, Shabonim Esayir. They translated it to Persian as though it said that the Jews are building the city. And if it were to be found out that this was a lie, if the king were to actually send messengers to go investigate what's going on, which they did not ask him to do, what did they tell him to do? What did they say the king should do? Look in your records to the history of the city. They did not say, please come send people to check it out. They don't want to be found out. So they send him the lie, and if the king were to find out it's a lie, lo haya magil emonish, they wouldn't be punished. Ki ma'amar ha'igeret sovel perush zeh, because you could read the original letter in the honest way as well, kemoshan l'fresh u'kein bemes, as we actually explain it. You could read the letter to say, we're building a temple, not building the city. So therefore, if the king comes back to them and says, how could you have written that? They say, oh, we misunderstood the letter. Which Rabbi Osterker supports the idea that they're based not locally, but they're based in Shushan, or wherever. And therefore, they don't know. We didn't see it. How are we to know that this wasn't true? The Gamla Kosvim Lohaya Magia Onesh, and there wouldn't be a punishment for the Samaritan writers of the letter either. Showing this not slim, they would apologize and excuse what they did. Shaya Kabanasam Kiparish Harishon Shabonim Shabbat Hamidish. We didn't mean to say that they're building this city. We said they're building a temple. Plausible deniability. You could read the sentence one way or the other. So Malvim this way satisfies the idea that this story is during the construction of the temple, and yet the letter comes off saying we're building the city, because it was actually to antagonize Cyrus. Cyrus didn't license them to build the city. Now the letter comes in saying these Jews are building up a city and it has a record of rebellion, and he's going to say, well, how dare they? And in the event that he investigates and finds out, no, there was no city. Oops, our bad. They must have been, you know, lost in translation. You follow?
Yes.
That's the that's the brilliance of Malvim's approach. Okay, so they're not going to pay the taxes, and we must do something about this. We have to get involved and write you a letter because we are loyal citizens. And they say this business about the salt, right? In Pasuk Yedaleh, in sentence 14. Right? We salt with the salt of the Heichal. So that's a very odd phrase to read. The approach that they take here in the Art Scroll I see is from Rashi, which they often do. They take the word Heichal not to refer to the king's palace, but the way we use Heichal often in Judaism, which is the temple, the Beis HaMikdash. Salting something is an act of what? Not when it's not bread.
Destruction.
Salting, you read about sacrifice, we'll come back to that. But salting is an act of destruction. Already back in Chumash, right, the idea of Gofrit Vamelach Sreifa Kol Artzai in Sodom, right, the salt being what does it, we see it in Shoftim, salting the earth. We'll see it for those who are in the Shoftim Shir on Thursday. We'll actually see that this Thursday. The idea of salting is destruction, and we wish to destroy the sanctuary. In other words, They're saying, why are we sending you this letter? Because we don't like them. And they're actually disclosing their agenda. That's the way that Rashi reads this. However, Malbim says that's not what's going on. Malbim says that's not the nature of salt in those days. Take a look at source number 3. And I have to tell you, I did research on this and did find it recorded in a book called A Political History of the Achaemenid Empire. So that supports the idea. He says, "Hamelach shotziu min haharim min hayam hayashayach el hamelach." The salt mined from the mountains or from the sea belonged to the king. Kamoshu ganayom berov malchuyos, as is done today, he says, in most lands. 18th century, Eastern Europe. I have no idea, but that's where Malbim lived.
There's a book, The History of Salts. Which yeah. Ridiculous.
No, I've heard of the book.
It actually, yeah. So,
for sure. No, just the idea though that it's considered the property of the king is what I find fascinating.
Hence Gandhi's march to the sea.
Oh, because
Mahatma Gandhi led the Indian Revolution. I mean, the starting point was that he said the salt belongs to all of us, and he marched to the sea and made salt from the salt water, which was illegal because the salt belongs to the king.
Ah, okay.
Apparently that's why the Windsor salt has been cast on it. Apparently it belongs to the king.
Really? Windsor salt belongs to the Duke of Windsor. Okay, go figure. Okay.
Salt also a preservative?
Yes, very much so. So
that's, isn't that opposite? Salting to destroy the sanctuary or salt to preserve?
Well, what you do is when you've destroyed something, you sow it with salt. Sow it with salt in order to keep anything from growing. That's the image. If when Hurricane Sandy hit Long Island and areas were flooded with salt water, so I was there, a year later, and stuff wasn't growing in areas where it had grown before, and trees were dead because of the salt from the salt water. So it's a preservative.
Negev, too. Because the Negev used to be covered by an entire sea.
Right.
And so there are whole areas of the Negev where nothing grows because they hit the salt out of the earth. That was just there.
Got it.
The act of preserving is stopping the growth of bacteria.
Oh, I understand that completely, but I'm just reading it.
As an expression of preservation.
As preservation.
Interesting.
It's confusing. What she's saying is that it's destroying the bacteria.
Right.
It's not preserving the meat.
Right, no, understood.
But basically, it is still a destroying thing. It's just destroying the thing that would...
Right. No. I think Helen's point is to suggest that maybe the Samaritans are writing, we want to preserve the palace. I think that's the image that you're trying to express. There are a lot of ways we can read it. There was a hand over in that direction, was there? Okay. So the Malbim's read is that the nations buy it off of the king. That's what it means when it says, we eat the king's salt. We are his servants, and therefore we are driven to write this letter because we are loyal to the king. It's also interesting in terms of the resources, actually. We talked about this a few weeks back. Cyrus is also the owner of wood. We talked about why they use the cedar from Lebanon, and we noted that later on it will be identified as Cyrus's forests. So, he has a lot going on in terms of his commercial empire.
I would say probably any raw materials belong to him.
Could be. Don Mikra has another idea, which I thought was interesting, that says that that it's a ceremony when you accept the king's command. There's some kind of a salt ceremony. Going back to the point that Ari made about the fact that on our korbanot, on our offerings, we always put brit melach, the covenant of salt. So Don Mikra suggests that there was a covenant of some kind with the king when you swore loyalty to him involving salt. But I haven't looked into whether that's found elsewhere. Bread and wine.
It's not bread and wine?
No. Bread and wine. Made for a much more fun meal. With due respect to the salt. So what we're seeing here is them saying, well, we have to get involved, because if we don't get involved, who knows what's going to happen to your empire. So, we're moved to intervene and warn you. It also reminds me, I think I mentioned on another occasion, the Temple of Chonio. that existed in Egypt. After the Avodah Zarah, the idolatrous temple in Elephantine, after that time, in roughly the time of Hanukkah, in the 160s before the Common Era, there's a fellow by the name of Chonio, who is either the son or the grandson of Shimon HaTzadik, from the line of priests who served in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, who flees to Egypt, to a place called Leontopolis. Some records have it as Alexandria, but Leontopolis, I think, is the way Josephus labels it. And he builds a temple there with permission of Ptolemy. And the temple stands until about 10 years after the second Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. The Gemara Menachos Daf Kuftes gives you the whole story about, you know, was it idolatrous, was it not idolatrous, but you have this breakaway temple in Egypt called Beit Chonio, the house of Chonio, or Onias, as Josephus writes about it. And the reason I mention it is only because when it's destroyed by the Romans, it's destroyed because somebody sends a letter to the Caesar, I believe, saying, and this is Josephus' record of the letter, the Jews are known for their innovation. It was very reminiscent, I forget the full phrase, but it was very reminiscent of what the Samaritans said. The Jews are known for their innovation, for being rebellious. If you let them do this, they're going to throw off your reign, they're going to stop paying your taxes. You just wait, look in your records, and you'll see that it's true.
What does innovation have to do with rebellion?
Meaning trying to do new things. We're not happy with the status quo. We have a talent for innovation. That could be taken in a lot of different ways.
I see that as complimentary.
Yeah.
Pejorative.
Right. No, it was pejorative. Definitely pejorative. And it's not the original Greek, obviously, that Josephus used. But yeah, look, we've also been called Ankeshe Oref, a stiff-necked people. It's not like the Samaritans are making it up. You know, it's just that they're using it against us. Sorry? Oh, yeah, no, we are. Yes, absolutely. Okay, once you hit like 40. So, sentence 17, we find the results of this letter. So we're going to read 17 through 24. You didn't believe me when I said we were speeding up now. I told you. 17 through 24, we get the impact. Pisgama shlach malka al rechum be'el te'em b'shimshai safra ush'ar k'navas hon di'yasvin b'shamrayin ush'ar aver nara. The letter was sent by the king to Rechum and to Shimshai and all of their allies who are living in Shomron. The allies are in Shomron, not necessarily Rechum and Shimshai. And the rest of Aver Nara, as in the area where we were living, Shalom, peace, Uche'es. I usually render Uche'es as and now, although Rashi and Ibn Ezra note, it could be a place like Ke'enes, which we saw last time. It could be a place. Interestingly, Malbim says the word shalom here doesn't mean peace. You know what he says it means? It means etc. Shalom, like shalem, whole, like, and all the rest of the things that are supposed to go. In other words, they're not going to bother recording all the honorifics every time, and the names of this one, and the names of that one, and what? Shalom, like, this is, and v'chule, v'gomer, this is the rest of the text. Here we get to the point. Nishtevana dishlachten aleina. The text that you sent to us, mefarash keri kadamai, was read out in front of me. Umini sim te'em. The order has been given from me. Uvakaru, they've investigated. Vashkachu, when they found. Di kiryas adach min yomas alma al malchin misnasah. That, yeah, this city has always been rebellious against kings. Umarad v'eshtador misaved ba, they rebel. Eshtador, again, is either another term for rebellion or a term for alliances. Umalchin takifin haval Yerushalayim. They were mighty kings over Jerusalem. Beshalithin b'chol aver nara. They ruled over the entire area west of the Jordan. Umida below v'halach misyahim lahon. And they pay the different taxes. Mida is minda. It's the same word. The nuns go in and out. In other cases, we've seen that. Ke'es and ke'enes. Itasa and intasa. So, they would pay taxes. There were mighty kings over them. Ka'an simu te'ein levatala guvraya ilech. So here's the instruction that I'm giving to you in order to sustain my reign, is that I don't have what happened to these others. What I would like to see What I would like to see happen is to stop these people from building. This city shall not be built up. So he is accepting that it was about them building the city. And he says, I don't want them building the city. Ad mini tama yitzam, until further notice. Right? Until I say otherwise. Uzihirin havo shalu lemebar al dina. This is an interesting phrase to translate. There are a couple of different approaches to the phrase here. Did I bring it on the sheet? No, I did not. So I'll tell it to you outside. Shalu means what? Shalu is a mistake usually, like shkaga. So it can mean, as Rashi says, shalu lemebad, make sure that you create shalu. Make sure that you damage what they've done. Make sure to damage their construction. However, the majority read is not that. Rather, the majority read is to say, be careful not to make a mistake. Be careful of making mistakes. In other words, I don't want you to err in this regard. It was a hirin havo, shalu lemeh baral dina. Don't make any mistakes with this. Lema yiske chavala lahanzakas malchin. Because why would you want to have more damage to the throne? And here you see another phrase that's an Esther phrase. The last two words. Right? What is that in Hebrew? Lenezek hamelech. Right? Esther says to Achashverosh, if they were just going to make us into slaves, I wouldn't bother you. It's the same phrase, which makes sense. They're contemporary. So the statement here is, I want you to halt the construction, make sure that they're not going to go any further. And Edayin, Pasuk Chav Gimel, sentence 23, Edayin means us at that point. Minidi Parshega Nishtavana di Artachshasta Malka, Keri Kadam Rechum Vishim Shai Safro Chnabazon, when the text sent by King Artachshasta was read out in front of Rechum and Shimshai and their allies, Azdalu bivihilu lirushlei mal Yehudaye, they rushed to Jerusalem, to the Jews, uvatilu himo be'edra b'chayel, and they stopped them with force. Edra is like Zeroah in Hebrew, the Zion and the Dalet interchange, with an arm, with a mighty hand, they halted the Jews from engaging in the construction. There's another Esther reference here. Did you catch it? In that sentence. You won't get... Yes, which is?
It's when Haman is defeated and he goes out in confusion and hurry from Achashverosh.
So all of the he doesn't, but the runners do.
Yes.
Haratzim yatzu dichufim bidvar hamelech. Whenever the runners are sent out in Megillat Esther, they're always rushing. They're always sent out on the run, dichufim, to be pushed. Right, the sign on the door in Israel when it's a push door is dichof. So they're always in haste, and here too, it's emphasized that they're doing it in haste, and they go to halt the construction. And Beidayin, at that point, Betelas Avidas Beis Elaka Di Birushalim, the construction of the house of God in Jerusalem was halted. Vahavas Batla, and it was halted at Shnas Tartin Lamachus Daryavesh Melech Paras until year 2 of the empire of Darius, till the reign of Darius. Notice that it said what was stopped? The construction of the Beis HaMikdash, not the city. Right? So either this sentence is part of the story, and in fact the story is from that period of time, bless you, or this sentence is the end bracket. The rest was this interlude, and now we're coming back to what we said before, which is the construction of the Beis HaMikdash was halted until year 2 of King Darius. That's the other way to... That's the other way to read this sentence. But that's what happens. The Samaritans are, at this point, successful. One note that I brought you on the sheet from Malbim in source number 4. By the way, it's actually Mevo Halim Utchufim when they go out. So you have the word Bahala there. But in source number 4, Malbim says, Al pi hatzas divrayim lo Allah al das hamelach sheyachkorim gufa davar emes shayehudim shinu es pekuda sa'u bonim chamasir belo rishu sa'u. Based on what he had been told, the king didn't even dawn on him to investigate, well, is this true? Have the Jews actually changed what I told them to do? Are they building up the wall of the city? He thought, these are my employees. I have to worry. They're going to lie in such a visible way? Oh, come on. Of course it's true. The only thing he had to do was check the records to learn about the city of Jerusalem. And so that's all that he does. One interesting point here in this, which I think I mentioned also a little bit last week, but it's very important with Purim coming up. According to the standard traditional chronology, which says that the king involved in this story is King Cyrus, what has he just done that Ahasuerush would never do?
Reversed his decision.
Yeah, he just reversed his decision. Remember, after Haman is defeated, and Esther and Mordechai Esther comes to Ahasuerush and says, you know, it's great that Haman is gone, but my people are still in danger, right? The Jews are not looking to go to war. People make a big deal about the bloodshed that's found in the 9th chapter in Esther, and they killed all those people. We weren't asking for a war. We said to the king, rescind the decree against us, and that's that. However, the king says, oh, sorry, you know, the rules are the rules. You can't retract. Once a text has been issued under the order of the king and sealed by the king's seal, it cannot be retracted. Well, Ahasuerus, there was somebody who was a lot more successful than you on the throne in Persia, right? His name was Cyrus. And apparently he didn't have a problem. So what's the deal? Why is it that that Cyrus is able to back down where Ahasuerus cannot? So two possibilities, right? Possibility number one is that this actually isn't Cyrus, and that feeds into the idea that this story is actually taking place later. And it's a later king reversing something that had been done generations earlier. And that's more acceptable. That's one way to do it. Go with that read. The alternative way to read it, though, is that Ahasuerus made up a rule. Because it's consistent with his identity. Right? Ahasuerus's biggest fear is being embarrassed. Right? That's why when his wife refuses to come out to the party, he makes it a major political event. Right? He turns it into this maid. I have to call all my advisors. I have to convene the National Security Council because my wife wouldn't come out to the party. What is wrong with you? What are you thinking? That's the theme of Megillas Esther. It's a longer story, and literally, you can read it. But that's the entire story, beginning to end, and it fits that he would make up a rule like, oh no, you can't rescind the decree. You'll have to come up with something new instead. Yeah, let there be a war in my kingdom. Let's have thousands of people die, because I don't want to go back on my word. That's who he is. So, okay, the construction is halted until year 2 of King Darius. This Darius, who we're talking about now, in whose time it's going to be started again, as we'll see, according to Rashi, this is Darius the son of Ahasuerus and Esther. That's who we're talking about here. That's the Darius who's actually going to lead the rebuilding. Ibn Ezra says, no, this Darius actually is Ahasuerus. Huh. But Ibn Ezra has been known, as we've already talked about, to rename kings on the fly in ways that contradict other comments of his. So I'm not sure if he's serious or not when he says it. But either way, the second year of King Darius is a very important year. Why is the second year of King Darius a very important year? So some of you were with me many years ago when we learned Haggai and Zechariah. Very, very good. You were there. Haggai and Zechariah. I know. I wouldn't have remembered either. I had to look it up. But if you just flip very quickly to page 1403, it's in Zechariah also, but I'll take the Haggai reference because we're almost out of time. The very beginning of the book of Haggai. page 1403. Bishnas Shtayim L'Daryavash HaMelech, the second year of King Darius, Bachodesh HaShishi, the sixth month, first day of the month, Rosh Chodesh Elul, that's its own discussion for those who are at Chagai Shirim that I've given. Hayadra Hashem b'yad Chagai Hanavi, message of Chagai, to Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel, Pachas Yehuda, and Yoshua ben Yostak, HaKohen HaGadol. They sound familiar, we know them. Saying, Ko Amar Hashem Tzvakos Lemor Ha'am Hazeh Amru Lo Eis Bo Eis Beis Hashem Lehibanos. You say the time has not yet come to build, and I say back to you, reading through the Pesukim, is it the time for you to sit in your houses? Right? Under your nice ceilings. And the house, my house is in ruins. Because it's been stopped all this time. Pay attention, see why you're suffering. And he tells them, jumping ahead to Pasuk Zayin, Pasuk Ches, sentence 8, Alu ha'har v'haveisem eitz ubnu bayis. Go up the mountain, take wood, build the house, and I will desire it, and so on. So in the second year of King Darius, that's what's going to change the game. Chagai and Zechariah are going to rally the Jews to start building against the instructions of the Persians. And so if you just look at the first sentence in Perek Hey, this is how I knew where to look. Chagai and Zechariah in that year, the second year of King Darius, prophesied upon the Jews in the name of God, and so, as you'll see, they start to build again. Well, you can imagine that this isn't going to go smoothly because the Persians have said not to build, so we'll have to talk about what happens, God willing, next week.